people in the house were all brought into the room.
Okay, welcome back to the 2S Horror Quarters podcast, Ghost of LA edition. Today we're going to cover the murders of Sharon Tate and her company at 10050 Cielo Drive on the night of August 8th into the early morning of August 9th, 1969. Of course, the official murders took place August 9th, 1969. We will also cover the murders of Rosemary and Lino LaBianca on the night of August 9th into the early morning of August 10th, 1969. The official murders on the LaBiancas were August 10th, 1969. The reason why I'm including the night before on each murder is because that's when these murders culminated and were already in progress as far as the planning of it and so forth. So there's a vast amount of information regarding this case over the years. Helter Skelter is the go-to book regarding this case by Vincent Bugliosi. It covers the murders before and after the trial. Mr. Bugliosi is who tried Manson and crew. His book is very detailed, and this is what I will go through. This is what I referred to give you these facts, timelines, and any other kind of vital information regarding these two nights. Now, I do know Helter Skelter has its problems and issues with its critics in regards to certain points of information or certain theories involved. But as Dearly Departed's Scott Michaels put it on Movie Geeks United when he was talking about Helter Skelter, the book, he said, "Helter Skelter is the truth of the trial." And that's fair. So beginning with the murders that took place at 10050 Cielo Drive on the morning of August 9th, the housekeeper, Mrs. Winifred Chapman, was dropped off at the bus stop at Santa Monica and Canyon. And just before she was going to hail a taxi, she saw somebody she knew. The gentleman took her up to the house, and she was dropped off at the front gate. Immediately as she approached the gate, she noticed that the wire was cut off the pole and hanging over the gate itself. Mrs. Chapman thought that initially it was power lines cut and that the power was out, but the gate did open for her. She grabbed the LA Times in the mailbox, and about 30 feet in front of the gate as she entered the grounds, there was a white vehicle, a white Rambler, parked kind of weird, kind of out of place. She passed it, didn't see anything out of place there, just thought it was a car parked oddly. What she did notice was there was an outside garage light that was still on, which was a little odd to her because it was still on and it's usually turned off. So she went to the garage, turned off the light. So Mrs. Chapman never enters through the front door. There's a service porch, and above the doorway to the service porch was a key that's hidden on the ledge. So she reached up, grabbed the key, and entered in through the kitchen. As she walked in, she checked the phone line and found out it was dead. And she made her way through the living room and came across these two blue steamer trunks. One of them looked like it had been knocked over, but they were right in her way. She knew that the trunks weren't there the night before, so again, something else that was a little odd to her. Now, from that point, she can see that there was blood on the trunks, blood on the floor next to the trunks, and blood on some towels on the floor next to that. Throughout the living room, there were red splashes of blood scattered sporadically. The front door was ajar. There were pools of blood on the front porch. And from a distance, she could see one body on the lawn. Now she was frantic. She bolted out of the house and came across that white Rambler on her way to exit the premises. And now she can see that there was a male, dead, slumped over inside of the white Rambler. And now she's freaking out. So she runs past the gates. Upon exiting the gate, she comes to the first house on the right, the first neighbor, a 10070 Cielo Drive. and this was the home of Mr. and Mrs. Cott, Seymour Cott. And she's frantically ringing the doorbell, knocking, no answer. She's screaming, murder, death, bodies, blood. Being that there was no answer there, she continued on to the neighbor's house past that at 10090 Cielo Drive, and that would be the home of the Aysons. The 15-year-old son that lived there, Jim Ayson, was outside warming up his father's car. His father was going to drop him off at the police station where he was working some type of volunteer work, where he was working the front desk answering phones. Being that she was frantic, Jim's parents came out and tried to calm her. Jim's father called it in at 8:33 a.m. That was the first call. So at that point, Jim and his father, Ray, took a walk to the gate. They looked through the gate and they could see the Rambler. They couldn't see anything inside of it, and of course they could see the cut phone lines. Now the first arriving officer was an Officer DeRosa. DeRosa was trying to calm Mrs. Chapman, and while doing so, he talked to Ray Ayson. Ray Ayson told him that the house was owned by Rudy Altobelli. Now Rudy Altobelli had a caretaker that usually stayed there, lived there, William Gerritsen. Mr. Ayson let Officer DeRosa know that the famous movie director Roman Polanski rented out the main house, and his wife Sharon Tate lived there. Sharon Tate was 8 months pregnant at the time. Now, originally, Sharon Tate and her husband Roman were in Europe for a while, and while they were in Europe, and Abigail Folger and Wojtek Frokowski were staying there. They were a couple. Abigail was one of the heirs to Folger's Coffee. So, after a while, Sharon came back from Europe, and Wojtek Frokowski and Abigail Folger ended up just staying there at the house with Sharon, you know, because she was pregnant and they didn't want to leave her alone. So at the time, it was the three of them living there. So now it starts to get a little more interesting as the seconds click away. Mrs. Chapman was unable to identify the bodies. She was pretty distraught. But she did make mention of the black Porsche that was in the driveway belonging to a Jay Sebring. Jay Sebring was a hairstylist to the stars at that time. A famous guy, pretty renowned, and a former lover of Sharon Tate's. But he was there hanging out, and she noticed and told police that his black Porsche was in the driveway. At this point, DeRosa grabs his rifle, heads to the gate with Mrs. Chapman just so she can open it up for him, and he enters. As he passes the Rambler, he takes a look inside and sees a male Caucasian slumped over towards the passenger side of the vehicle. He appeared to be a teen and soaked in blood. At this time, the second officer rolls in, an Officer Wisenhunt. DeRosa informs and updates Wisenhunt on what's going on. The two of them both have shotguns now and re-enter the premises. They approach the Rambler, take another look at it, makes note that the window is down, the driver's side window. A third officer rolls up, an Officer Burbridge, and he catches up with him. Now all three officers are armed and on the premises. So just past the gate was the parking area, and there is the garage with the porch light that was on. Just past the garage, you enter the lawn area if you're walking parallel to the home. So on the parking area side of the walkway to the front entrance, there was a wishing well, and as you cross that walkway, you're back on the lawn. Then past the house itself is the swimming pool. Sharon Tate's master bedroom led out to the swimming pool area. And just past that is the guest house. Now in front of the lawn itself was a split rail fence that had Christmas lights on it. And they were on pretty much every night. Those lights were put up by Candace Bergen when she lived there with Terry Melcher. And in front of the split rail fence, there was like a little slope, probably 6 to 8 feet downward, that led to a walkway, and that walkway led from the guest house back to the parking lot. So that was pretty much the layout of the front grounds of the house. From a distance, they spot two bodies on the lawn. The bodies look out of place. They kind of look like mannequins laid out, soaked in red paint, but they look obscure and extremely out of place. Now about 20 feet past the front door lay the first body. One Wojtek Frokowski. He was lying on his side and resting on his right arm, face horribly battered. Torso and body had been punctured. Bell bottoms, short boots, purple shirt, and casual vest. 25 feet past Wojtek was Abigail Folger. She was lying on her back, arms thrown out and barefoot, and was in a nightgown. At this point, Wisenhunt and Burbage went for the house looking for a safe way in. Noticing a screen popped off and leaning against the house, the two officers found another way in. Now reading directly from Helter Skelter, Wisenhunt also observed a horizontal slit along the bottom of the screen. Suspecting this might have been where the killer or killers entered, they looked for another means of entry. They found a window open on the side. Looking in, they saw what appeared to be a newly painted room, devoid of furniture. They climbed in. DeRosa waited until he saw them inside of the house, then approached the front door. There was a patch of blood on the walk between the hedges, several more on the right side corner of the porch, with still others just outside and to the left of the door and on the door jamb itself. The door being open inward, DeRosa was on the porch before he noticed that something had been scrawled on its lower half. Painted in what appeared to be blood were three letters. There's a famous picture of Roman Polanski after the murders coming to visit the site, and he's sitting next to that door, and it's pretty traumatizing to see, you know, to imagine the pain that he must have been feeling there, considering what was lost, who was lost. Now, DeRosa does a sweep of the house, and he comes across the same steamer trunks that Winifred Chapman came across when she first entered the service porch. Now, on the floor next to the steam trunks were some horned rim glasses. Officer Burbridge finds some pieces of broken wood, which to him looked like pieces of a broken gun grip, so he made note of that. Now, going in deeper to the premises, into the living room, facing the fireplace was a long white couch, and it had an American flag draped over the back of it. On the other side of the couch was Sharon Tate and Jay Sebring. She was young, blonde, and very pregnant. She was laying on her left side in a fetal position, wearing matching flowered bra and bikini panties. There was a white nylon rope wrapped around her neck twice, then ran over the rafters, tied to the body of a man who was on the other side, not too far away from her. And this was Jay Sebring. The rope wrapped his neck twice as well, and a bloody towel covered his face. He was 5'6". His hands were up to his face as if he had been warding off an attack. Blue shirt, white pants, black vertical stripes, black boots, and he was drenched in blood. There was a wooden ladder that led to a loft above the living room. DeRosa climbed that ladder expecting to see more carnage. Nothing was there, but he had to check. Now, searching the rest of the house, he found one of the bedrooms down the hallway had clothes thrown about. Pillows and a blanket were rumpled. Now, to them, they deducted that possibly the woman in the nightgown out on the lawn occupied this room. Across the hall was a master, a longer bed. There was a blood smudge on the inside left of the French doors coming out of that room, leading to the swimming pool outside. From that, they deducted that this was a possible escape route from one of the victims, and that's how the blood got there. As the officers approached the guest house that Mr. Aysen told them about, they not only heard a dog barking, but they heard a male voice saying, "Shh, keep it down," or "Shh, be quiet." Considering the scene and everything that was going on and how many bodies were found, this was huge. They carefully peeked through the windows, and through the windows they can see what looked like to be an 18-year-old male with his shirt off, jeans on, listening to some music. And DeRosa kicks in the door. There was a dog in there, and that was Rudy Altobelli's dog. It was a Warmer Rainer. I think I'm pronouncing that wrong. But the dog was being cared for by this caretaker. When they busted through the door, this dog started chomping on Wisenhunt's barrel of his shotgun, so they had to pin the dog between the door to get him to calm down. When the officers brought out William Gerritsen out onto the lawn, he was so distraught that he misidentified the victims. He thought one of them was Winifred Chapman and the other one was Roman Polanski. So, you know, this didn't help him out in the eyes of the officers. You know, a guy that was there, five people dead, he hears nothing, sees nothing, and he's maybe 50 feet away, 60 feet away from the main residence. So this just doesn't look right, so they haul him in. As we all know, Mr. Gerritsen was cleared, but for that first few weeks, it was hell for him, and probably throughout life, you know. I mean, this is a traumatizing event. It was finally confirmed he had nothing to do with anything, but it weighed on Mr. Gerritsen for years on, and he was quoted as saying, "How come I wasn't murdered?" And it was survivor's guilt that really weighed on him. So 10050 Cielo Drive was complete carnage. Just a massacre. 5 victims up in this ritzy area, you know, overlooking Los Angeles, essentially, and one of the better views, arguably the best view in town of the city, where things like this just don't happen. And here it is, out of a horror movie, happening. You know, 5-6 victims, because I count Paul, the unborn child of Sharon Tate and Roman Polanski. 6 victims. You got Sharon Tate, her son Paul, Jay Sebring, Wojtek Frokowski, Abigail Folger, and Stephen Parent, which is a tragic story on its own, you know, which we'll get into a little later about Stephen Parent's story. And I think he's one of the overlooked victims. Of course, we all count him as far as being a victim that night, but because of where he was and the company that was also on that premises, he's kind of forgotten. And I just want to make sure we remember him. And like I said, we'll cover Stephen Parent a little later on. So now we're going to move into the timeline of the day, the last day the victims at 10050 Cielo Drive were alive. Based on the investigation, I'm going to go down the list here so we kind of get an idea of what happened in and around that area, in and around that residence the day before. So at 8 a.m., Mrs. Chapman arrived at Cielo, and she did the dishes. She did her usual cleaning duties. 8:30 a.m., Frank Guerrero arrived. Now, he was a painter who was painting the nursery, getting it ready for the child that was due probably in less than a month. In doing so, he removed the screens to air out the room after the paint. At 11 a.m., Roman Polanski called and spoke with Sharon, and according to Mrs. Chapman, the phone call kind of spoke about Sharon. Sharon was kind of worried that Roman wouldn't be back in time for his birthday, which was, I believe, the 12th of August. Another phone call came in about a neighbor's kitten that was roaming around, and Sharon told the neighbor that now she's got the kitten there and she's feeding the kitten. It's reported that Sharon was taking care of, in total, 26 cats. Terry Melcher apparently had some cats up there when he moved out that stayed and became a group of like 26 cats. And there were also 2 dogs that Sharon was looking after. Mrs. Chapman also noted that during the heat, that Sharon Tate's attire was usually just brown panties because it was so hot, because she was uncomfortable being pregnant, walking around in that heat. Just before noon on August 8th, 1969, that same day, Mrs. Chapman washed down the paw prints at the front door. Now we're going to get back to Stephen Parent a little bit, who lived in El Monte. He had lunch at home around that time. Now, he had 2 jobs. His first job was at a plumbing supply. His second job was at a stereo shop. So he came home. He had lunch at home. And he asked his mom to lay out his clothes for him so he can, when he's done with his first job, he can just change real quick, head to the second job. Now back on Cielo Drive, about 12:30, 2 of Sharon's friends, a Joanna Pettit and a Barbara Lewis, stopped by for lunch to hang out. At 1 p.m., Sandy Tennant called, a friend of Sharon's. Sharon invited her to stop by. Sandy declined, for whatever reason. Rudy Altobelli had 2 gardeners that would come to the house and take care of the gardening duties. Around 1 p.m., the first guy came, David Martinez. He entered the premises, and so did Abigail Folger and Wojtek Frokowski. They were coming in as well. The painter, Frank Guerrero, he finished the first coat around 1:30, and he left the screens off. Now, about 2 p.m., Abigail Folger visits the bike shop on Santa Monica Boulevard. According to Dennis Hurst, during the trial, she was actually exchanging a bike that she had previously purchased, and that newly exchanged bike was the bike that was to be delivered that night to 10050 Cielo Drive. And so here's the stuff that I get caught up on here, the bike shop here, where the location of the bike shop. Now, it's been noted that the bike shop was on the southeast corner of Little Santa Monica Boulevard and Camden Drive. And what I found here, the southeast corner of South Santa Monica Boulevard and Camden was the original bike shop. At 3 p.m., the second gardener arrived, a Tom Vargas. Now, as Tom arrived, Abigail was leaving in her Camaro, separately from Wojtek Frykowski, who was leaving in his Firebird. So they passed each other at the gate. Now, doing some more research on this, shout out to mansonblog.com, I found out that there was an error as far as what car that Abigail Folger was driving. It appears that Abigail Folger's car was a 1968 Pontiac Firebird 400. So thank you, mansonblog.com, for pointing that out. Joanna Pettit and Barbara Lewis leave Cielo around that time. Now, roughly around this same time, Jay Sebring, who was at home, not too far away, his butler reported serving breakfast to Jay and his female companion. At 3:45, Jay Sebring called Sharon Tate and let her know that he would be arriving at her residence sooner than he thought he would be, but he would be there. Just after the call with Jay Sebring, Mrs. Chapman informed Sharon that she was done with her duties. Now, another twist of fate here, which is good for Winifred Chapman, is that Sharon offered to have Winifred just stay the night because it was so hot, and Winifred declined. And obviously, if she would have stayed, we know what would have happened. So that was fortunate for Winifred, relatively speaking. So David Martinez was leaving, and as he was leaving, he took Winifred Chapman either back to the bus stop or home. Tom Vargas remained behind. Now, he reported to the police that he was working near the house and he saw Sharon was asleep through the window. So when the delivery guy came with the two steamer trunks, the blue ones, Mr. Vargas signed for him. The signature on that receipt was 4:30 p.m. At 4:45, before Vargas left the residence, he went to the guest house to talk to William Garrison. And he asked William to do some extra watering over the weekend because it was going to be extremely hot. Now, back in El Monte, back to Stephen Parent, he got home around this same time. He changed his clothes and he waved bye to his mom and he left for a second job. Between 5:30 and 6 p.m., we're getting closer to the murders now, a woman by the name of Terry Kay was backing out of her driveway at 9845 Easton Drive and saw Jay Sebring pass by in his black Porsche. So we can deduct that Jay Sebring arrived at the Cielo residence somewhere around that time, probably just after 6. Now, another twist of fate is between 6 and 6:30, Sharon Tate's younger sister, Debbie Tate, she was 13 at the time, she called and asked her sister if she can stop by tonight with some friends. And Sharon Tate told her sister, no, not tonight. We'll do it another time. Between 7:30 and 8 p.m., Dennis Hurst was a delivery driver that brought the bicycle to the residence that Abigail purchased. Now, during the investigation, Mr. Hurst identified through photos that it was Jay Sebring who answered the door to take the delivery of the bicycle, and that Mr. Hurst didn't see anyone else there at that time, just Jay Sebring at the front door. So we do know that Jay Sebring was at Cielo between 7:30 and 8. So according to Helter Skelter, it was roughly 2 p.m. that Abigail and Wojtek were at the bicycle shop. However, I come across a great podcast by Movie Geeks United. It's called August 69, and this particular episode is episode 3, The Delivery Man. This is from Dennis Hurst. It's 50 years later. This was recorded in 2019. And I want to thank Movie Geeks United for letting me use this. So take a listen as he recounts what happened that night.
Came into the shop. I don't know, it was like maybe 5:30 or something. And I said, hey, Dad, can I have the van tonight for take Janice out to a movie for my birthday? And he said, yeah, but and I can ride my bicycle home. It's about 5 miles up the canyon to the house. And my dad often rode the bicycle. In fact, he looked for an opportunity to ride the bike, so he was happy to give me the van. But he said, you have to make a delivery. And I made lots of deliveries. And but you can't deliver it now on the way up the canyon because they're going to be out to dinner. And so you have to deliver it after 7:30. Yeah, he said, yeah, on Wednesday, somebody was in the bike shop and they bought a Raleigh Superb or whatever it was. And I delivered it that night, Wednesday night. Then they called this morning and said, no, we don't want the green one. We want the blue one. So I need you to drive up there and drop off the blue bike and pick up the green bike. Now, it's a little bit tricky because the address is Cielo, but it's actually off of Angelo. And so what you have to do is, you know, go up and then just turn up, and it looks like a long driveway. There's a few homes on it. And then when you get to the gate, just feel around in that bush. There's a button. Just push that button, and the gate will open. And I said, okay. So I went home, showered, changed. And I don't know, around 7:30, maybe it was 7:15, maybe it was 7:45, so somewhere around there. And my brother Michael had also been to that house when Rudy Altobelli lived there 2 years earlier. He's the one who rented the house to Terry Melcher. And so there was, and I think maybe my brother said, oh, yeah, I know that place. Or maybe he told me the story later or whatever. Oh, yeah, I know that place because that's where I got the Kinkajou. And so anyway, so my dad gave me the directions. I went home, showered, changed, and in the early evening, it was August, so it was still daylight, I made the delivery. And I remember distinctly driving in, and when I delivered a lot of these estates in Beverly Hills, Bel Air, whatever, there would be some kind of a pressure plate, or like at the gas station, that little black cord that went across, you drive across it, it would close the gate behind you. So I looked carefully around to make sure I drove over it to close the gate, but there was nothing there on the driveway. And I just noticed in my mirror that a minute later, the gate just closed, so it was a cheaper addition. And so I went to the garage. The garage door was open. I picked up the green bike, delivered the blue bike, and then I went around, if you're familiar with the property, I went around to the little front gate by the little wishing well, and then the flagstone stairs to the porch, the front door, rang the doorbell, and a gentleman answered the door. I found out later it was Jay Sebring, and he had a bottle in his hand, like a green glass bottle, like a Spignata or, I don't know, some kind of a inexpensive wine-type small bottle drink. And I said, yeah, I'm from the bike shop. I just want to let you know I picked up the bike, dropped off the bike. It's in the garage, whatever. The instruction cards are on it and everything else. And he said, okay, thank you, whatever. I mean, we barely exchanged 25 or 50 words. And then I left.
So on August 9th, Mr. and Mrs. LaBianca drove up to Lake Isabella to not only pick up the boat that they left there for Frank and Susan, who were Rosemary's children from a previous relationship. So they drove up to Lake Isabella to retrieve the boat and bring back Frank. Now, Frank, who was having so much fun, begged to stay, and they let him stay. So Mr. and Mrs. LaBianca and Susan drove home with boat in tow without Frank. Now, on August 10th, just after 1 a.m., the LaBiancas dropped off Susan at her apartment on Greenwood Place. So here we are at the El Pueblo Apartments at 4616 Greenwood Place in L.A. This is where Susan Struthers lived and was dropped off by the LaBiancas that night in 1969. This apartment building is also used as the exterior for the apartments in Melrose Place. In case it looks familiar to anyone, that's where it's from. And from there, they stopped at a newsstand located on Hillhurst and Franklin. The owner of the newsstand was a John Fokianos, and he recognized Lino's Thunderbird with boat in tow as it U-turned around and pulled up in front of his newsstand. Here we are at the corner of Hillhurst and Franklin, where the LaBianca stopped to pick up that newspaper from Mr. Fokianos. And I spoke to him about the murders on the previous night on Cielo Drive. And this here was the last point of contact, outside of the killers, of course, that the LaBiancas had with anyone else. Mr. Fokianos, he said that, you know, during the investigation, he said that the couple looked tired, but they did have small talk about what was front page news, and that was the Tate murders. And that Mrs. LaBianca looked kind of worried about it, frightened, you know. That's a huge murder. It's a huge, gruesome murder that happened in town. So I can imagine at 1 a.m. hearing this type of news and going home is, you know, wasn't a good feeling. So Mr. Fokianos was probably the last person to see them alive outside of their killers. Now we're into August 10th, 1969. Frank is dropped off by whoever he was with coming back from Lake Isabella at about 8:30 p.m. The first thing that Frank notices is Lino's Thunderbird and boat still parked out on the street, which is way out of character, because he knows Lino would have parked it by now, you know. So he takes his luggage up the long driveway. If you haven't been there and seen the pictures, it's a long driveway up to the main house. Frank stows his luggage and stuff in the garage, and he goes around to the back door of the home, and he notices right away something was out of place because the shades were down, and they really were never down. The kitchen light was on. Frank knocked a few times. He called out a few times, no answer. So he took a walk, which it wasn't a short walk to me. I mean, it was down a pretty long street, but there was a burger stand in the area on the corner of Hyperion and Rowena. Now Frank used the payphone there to try to reach his sister Susan. He called the restaurant she was working at, and the manager got on the phone and said she was off that day. But if you give me the number to your payphone, let me call your sister and have her call you. And that's what happened. Susan called the payphone, in which Frank relayed the news to her about what he saw at the house. Susan said, just wait there.
So here we are at the LaBianca residence at what was 3301 Waverly Drive. And you really can't get a great shot of the house now with the trees and the gate and everything, but you can see the long driveway. This part over here to the right, this additional driveway with the parking area, that's been added on. I was able to include the actual sound of the neighborhood during this time in the morning. I know it's been over 50 years, but where this house sits, it's extremely quiet, even at 8:30 in the morning or whatever time it was. Okay, based on the research that I did, I haven't been able to confirm this yet, but it makes the most sense that Frank, when he did take the walk, it was the street called St. George. That's right down his driveway and to the left. It's a long street, but I estimate that this is the street he walked down to get to the corner of Rowena and Hyperion to what was then a Charburger. Here we are in front of it. It's a Mixto restaurant now. I believe the payphone sat right about here. And this is the area where he did use the phone. Another little tidbit here is the telephone pole directly in front of Mixto has two marker nails on it. The one on the left represents the height of the pole, which is 55 feet, which puts it about 7.5 feet in the ground. The marker nail to the right, 61, is the year the pole was put in. So this pole right here was here then. So at 9:30 p.m. approximately, Susan and her boyfriend Joe Dorgan picked up Frank at that payphone, and they drove to the house on Waverly. Now, in Helter Skelter, it said they opened the door with a set of keys that Rosemary left in her car, but it's also noted in the book that since no one tried opening the door before the keys were retrieved, we don't know whether it was locked previously. Dorgan told Susan to stay in the kitchen while he and Frank checked the house out. And they find Lino first. He was sprawled out on his back, a throw pillow over his head, and there was a cord around his neck and something protruding from his stomach. So Joe picked up the kitchen phone and then put it down because he feared that he would ruin evidence. He told Susan everything is okay and let's get out of here as they rushed out of the house.
Across the street, there was a duplex, and it appears to be still a duplex. I know the structure's still there at 3308 Waverly. They went knocking on the door across the street there, and naturally, the people that were living there were like, you know, we'll call for you, but we're not going to let you in. So during that commotion, as the residents at 3308 were telling Joe, hey, we'll call for you, but we're not going to let you in, Joe went right next door to 3306. And the Brigham couple let him use the phone, and he was able to call the police at that point. Approximately 10:40 to 10:42, two officers arrived, a W.C. Rodriguez and a J.C. Tony, and they entered the premises with Joe. Susan and Frank stayed across the street. Once Rodriguez saw the scene, he immediately called backup, called a supervisor, called for an ambulance. And what he found was, in addition to the pillow that Joe and Frank had seen, there was a bloody pillowcase over Mr. LaBianca's head. The cord around his neck was attached to a nearby lamp. His hands were tied with a leather thong behind his back. And there was an ivory-handled carving fork that was plunged into his stomach. Someone carved war into his belly. In the other room, Rosemary was lying face down on the bedroom floor, parallel to the bed and dresser, in a large pool of blood. She had on a short pink nightgown with an expensive dress over that. Both garments were bunched over her head and exposed pretty much her complete backside, and an extreme amount of stab wounds. Her hands weren't tied, but a pillowcase was over her head and a lamp cord was around her neck. And based on the tautness of the cord, officers deducted that she still tried to crawl as it was wrapped around her neck, because the cord itself was tight. And 2 feet away from that was a second pool of blood. Going through the house, you know, everyone's seen what was written on the walls and on the refrigerator, but a more precise look at that was that on the north wall in the living room, "Death to Pigs" was written in blood. On the south wall, left of the front door, read "Rise." And on the refrigerator door, "Helter Skelter" was written. Now, it wasn't spelled H-E-L-T-E-R. It was H-E-A-L-T-E-R. Helter Skelter. I'm going to guess that it was just misspelled. I don't think there was any intentional motive there to write it that way. That's just my guess. And that was an extremely brutal scene. Now, not as brutal as the one on Cielo, you know, considering there was 2.5 times more victims. But even with these murders happening back-to-back nights, police and authorities still didn't think to connect the two at this point. What we do know about the Cielo murders is as follows. We do know it was an extremely quiet night, but they first drove the car up Cielo off of Benedict Canyon. Now, there were 4 people inside of that vehicle that night. Linda Kasabian, then they had Charles Tex Watson, Susan Atkins, and Patricia Krenwinkel. They drove up, Tex cuts the phone line, and presumably they back straight down because it's extremely narrow going up that private drive there. Now, in this shot here from lsb3.com, you can see, if you're approaching the gate from Cielo to enter the premises, you can see the telephone wire coming across there, and that's just another reference point. You can see it's cutting across the road there to the pole on the left-hand side as you approach the gate. And here's another shot of investigators pointing up at the pole. So here you can see the steps that are on the pole, steps or pegs, I call them steps, and they're so you don't have to climb them with your gaffs, depending on where the pole is positioned. But at any rate, the idea is you can't just grab the steps from ground level. You either got to stand on something or get a ladder or even use your hooks to climb up there to grab the steps. So that's how he was able to access the wires to cut, by climbing those steps there. So in this shot here, the camera is actually on the premises of 10050 looking out of the gate. So you can see on the right there where the original pole stood
on the right-hand side. So if you're coming up Cielo, approaching the gate, the original pole that Tex climbed was on the left, and you can see the direction of where the wires laid. Now as you approach the gate on Cielo, the pole is to the right, which that's not the original pole, nor is it where the original pole sat. Now here we went up Cielo Drive, and it didn't turn out too good. We got honked at and cursed out, and you know, that's fair. We really shouldn't be up there. It's extremely narrow. It's people's homes and pretty much essentially a driveway, so I wouldn't recommend going up there, at least for me again. But I just wanted to get a good shot of the gate. This is the best one that I could come up with. They backed down and parked pretty close to the intersection at Cielo and Benedict Canyon, then walked back up and got past the gate. To the right of the gate, there was a little embankment. Before we kind of go into everything that happened up there, I do want to say that Stephen Parent met William Gerritsen. From what I've read, Stephen Parent picked up William Gerritsen, who was hitchhiking, and dropped him off there. And William Gerritsen said, hey, if you're ever in the area, stop by. So Stephen Parent had a transistor radio that he was going to try to sell to William Gerritsen. So he did stop by. William was not interested in that. So, you know, after they hung out for a little bit, Stephen Parent was exiting, and as he was exiting, it was in that same moment that he was confronted by Tex, just as Tex got past the gate. But Tex went out by himself as he saw Stephen Parent's headlights coming towards the gate. Unfortunately, Stephen was shot 5 times by Tex, and there was a knife-like slash on his left hand.
A car came up to the driveway, and I remember Tex getting out, and without saying anything, there were gunfire shot. I was in the bushes, and...
That's when the young boy, Stephen Parent, was killed in the car, outside.
Right.
Tex enters through a front window and lets in Susan and Patricia Kremwinkel. Now, Sharon Tate and Jay Sebring are in the back bedroom hanging out. The killers grab those two and bring them to the living room. Abigail Folger was in her room reading a book. And she actually waves to Susan Atkins, thinking that she was just a visitor that someone else knew at the party or at the house hanging out. They then bring Abigail to the living room. Wojtek was already asleep on the couch in the living room. So at this point, there are 1, 2, 3, 4 people in the living room. Wojtek was a large man. He was able to break the ties and flee, as did Abigail Folger. And they both made it outside the premises. Tex chases down Wojtek and stabs him 51 times in the lawn area and shoots him twice. Patricia Krenwinkel chases Abigail down outside, stabs her 28 times. Two bodies are on the lawn now, and during that stabbing, Abigail said to Patricia that, I'm dead already, you can stop stabbing me. Jay Sebring is now in the house with Sharon, and he is shot once and stabbed 7 times by Tex, leaving Sharon Tate, the last of the victims, to be laying there with her child inside of her, fighting for her life, begging for her life. And they showed her no mercy. Susan stabbed Sharon 16 times.
I can remember seeing people just scattering in different places and running in different places. And I was left sitting with Sharon Tate. And she was talking to me. And I remember that I had absolutely, I felt nothing. I felt absolutely nothing for her. And she begged for her life and for the life of her baby. And, Jesus. I remember when we first went in, one of the people said, "Who are you?" And the text said, "I'm the devil, and I'm here to do the devil's business."
It's important to note that Susan Atkins later on said that she didn't actually do the stabbing, that it was Tex. But I believe Susan the first time. You know, I think this was after she was locked up for X amount of years that she changed her story.
The first set of neighbors as you leave 10050 Cielo Drive are Mr. and Mrs. Seymour Cott.
So Mr. and Mrs. Cott had dinner guests over that night, the night of 8-8, and those guests left around midnight. Now, according to Mrs. Cott, somewhere between 12:30 and 1 a.m., she does remember hearing 3 to 4 gunshots, but thinking nothing else of it, she went to bed. So about 3/4 of a mile south of the residence, there was a Westlake School for Girls, and there was a counselor by the name of Tim Ireland. They were having an outdoor campout, and he heard what he thought was gunfire around 12:40. They seemed like a long distance away, is what he said, north to northeast. And he remembers hearing a male screaming, though, "Oh God, no, please don't, oh God, no, don't. That scream, according to Mr. Ireland, lasted about 10 to 15 seconds. So Ireland lets another counselor know that, hey, this is what I heard. I'm going to go take a drive. And he took a drive around the area, not to the specific street or anything, because there was no way of really telling where that was. Circled the area, didn't see anything out of place. Here we are at Harvard Westlake School, currently in 2021. And you can see, from the view that I got anyway, you can see right up to the hill where the Cielo location stood. And on a quiet night, you know, this estimates it at 0.44 miles away, but on a quiet night up in those hills, you can probably hear pretty crystal clear as far as what was going on up there. So any kind of gunshots or probably even screaming, I could see them hearing that. At 9951 Beverly Grove Drive, a man by the name of Emmett Steele, he was awakened by his hunting dogs on or around 2 to 3 a.m. So here's an aerial shot showing 9951 Beverly Grove Drive and the distance it was from 10050 Cielo. It has it at 0.37 miles. Again, the quiet night, and it's not going to be a problem to hear the commotion going on up there. In front of 2175 Summit Ridge Drive, there was a Bel Air patrol employee named Richard Bullington. He called it in at his headquarters to an Eric Carlson, who then called it in to the West LA Division of LAPD at 4:11 a.m. According to Bullington, there were 3 shots that were spaced a few seconds apart. When the call went in to LAPD, the officer remarked, "I hope we don't have a murder. We just had a woman screaming call in that area." And in this one here, you can see it was 0.77 miles away from the 2175 Summit Drive address to 10050 Cielo Drive. Again, close, quiet hills. You're going to hear things. At 4:30 to 4:45 a.m., the LA Times paperboy pedaled his bike up Cielo. And that's pretty steep. But he pedaled his bike up Cielo, and he did notice what he thought to be phone wire draped over the gate, as well as the yellow bug lights still on the side of the garage. He puts the paper in the mailbox and leaves. At 7:30 a.m., Seymour Cott went to retrieve his paper and noticed the phone wire was down as well, hanging over the side of the fence, and also the light on still on the outside of the garage. So apparently, the light being on in the daytime at 10050 Cielo Drive, that light on the outside of the garage is always off, so when it was left on, more than a few people noticed the difference. So at this point, the killers went back down the hill, jumped in the vehicle, and headed up Benedict Canyon, where they then made a right on Portola Drive. Portola Drive is extremely narrow street, so they pull up to 9870 Portola Drive, get out, and start hosing off at this hose spigot that's in the yard.
Now, according to the testimony of Linda Kasabian, when they went up Portola Drive, they made a U-turn and came back down. They got out to use the hose, and first the woman that lived there came out, you know, asking questions, "Who are you?" warning them that her husband was a deputy, and they just said they just wanted some water. So
about 1 o'clock, I heard the sound of boiling water. So I jumped out of bed and grabbed the flashlight, and I went downstairs into the basement, opened the garage door, thinking that something had gone wrong with the plumbing. There was nothing wrong with it. I couldn't see any water of any kind. And then I heard voices on the street outside. So I went over, and here were four people standing. And of course, you know the exact place.
Yes.
Around the corner there. Well, I cannot describe the people except the man, the boy was rather tall. The girls I hardly saw, except I knew one of them was short stature. So I put the flashlight on and I said, "Just what do you think you're doing?" He says, "We're just getting a drink of water. And we're sorry to disturb you." Looking over the people, I figured, well, they're just teenagers out on a Friday night. Well, that I couldn't say, but from what I would guess, they were all Caucasian. The girl started walking down, then I looked down the street and I see a car park facing west towards the main canyon, under the canyon. So they started proceed to go down the street towards the car in front of me, and I followed them. When I got to the car, he, I believe, opened the back door to the back seat, and the girls got in, but then the dome light was on, and I happened to look inside the car, and it was all messed up and dirty and so on and so forth, things on the floor. So they closed the door, he got into the driver's seat. So in order to scare him, I acted as if I were going to reach for the keys. And that minute, he stepped on his daughter and he took off before he closed down the street.
And they made a right. Now the drive from the Cielo address to the Portola Drive address, where they use the hose, shows it being 1.9 miles away, give or take. And here we are on Portola Drive. As you can see, it's extremely narrow. If someone was coming down the street, we'd have to move for him. And it was right about in this area at this home here was where that hose spigot was. I can't really tell at this point where it would be now or even if it's still there, but it was somewhere in this area is where Tex and the group stopped for water. And from there, they made a right on Benedict Canyon. And right about the area of 2901 Benedict Canyon, across the street from that home, they tossed the clothes over a fence down an embankment. These clothes were later found by reporters who, on a whim, they took an educated guess, maybe not a whim, about leaving Cielo Drive and how long would it take to disrobe and get rid of our clothes. They pulled off on that same dirt patch and saw the clothes well after the murders. And that's how the bloody clothes were discovered. So from that point, they continued on to Benedict Canyon Road and made a left on Mulholland and a right on Beverly Glen. Now Tex throws the gun out of the car with his left hand over the car because he was driving at this point. And from that throw, the gun is slung into the backyard of Stephen Weiss, who we talked about earlier. Now what we do know about the murders of the LaBiancas on Waverly Drive is, according to Charles Manson, there was a guy named Harold True that lived next door to the LaBiancas that Manson and his group had partied before at that house. So this is how he picked that house or that street. So now the seven people piled into this car are Charles Manson, Linda Cassay being the driver, Steve Clem Grogan, Charles Tex Watson, Susan Atkins, Patricia Krenwinkel, and a Leslie Van Houten. Manson goes up, peeks through the window, and he can see that Lino is reading the paper. He comes back down, he gets text, and the two of them enter the house through a side door
tie up Rosemary and Lino in the living room. Charlie and Tex come back down the driveway, where Charles sends Leslie Van Houten and Patricia Krenwinkel to go back up with Tex and do as he says. They enter the house, and Mr. and Mrs. LaBianca at this point are in the living room. The girls take Mrs. LaBianca back to the room. Tex stays in there with Lino and stabs Lino 12 times with a bayonet. Mr. LaBianca says, "Enough, I'm dead already," which is what Abigail Folger had said the previous night. Now, upon hearing these screams, Mrs. LaBianca in the other room is screaming, "What have you done to my husband?" and starts to fight these two girls, Leslie Van Houten and Patricia Krenwinkel, in the room, swinging a lamp at them, doing whatever she can to fight them off. At this point, Tex comes in, and Rosemary is stabbed 41 times, 16 times post-mortem by Leslie Van Houten, because Tex told her and reminded her that Charles Manson said to contribute somehow. So because of this, she stabbed Mrs. LaBianca post-mortem 16 times.
And then Tex turned me around, and he handed me a knife, and he said, "Do something." And so I went in, and Mrs. LaBianca was laying on the floor, and I stabbed her in the lower back around 16 times.
Back out in the living room, Mr. LaBianca stabbed with a fork 7 times, leaving 14 more punctures, and they carved "War," W-A-R, into his abdomen, leaving the fork protruding from his abdomen. Then they leave a steak knife in his neck. They take a shower, go through the fridge, pet the dogs, and they leave. What's really bizarre is that Charles and Linda and Steve and Susan, they weren't out there waiting for them. They left. So this forced Tex and the two girls, Leslie Van Houten and Patricia Krenwinkel, to hitchhike home. Tex had said he got rid of the bayonet in a body of water. There's a reservoir down the street from the LaBiancas, a large reservoir, that maybe he threw it into that body of water. I've never seen anything where they said they found it. If anyone has, please note that. Let me know. That's, you know, I've always wanted to find that out to see where whatever happened to that bayonet. So Tex, Leslie, and Patricia hitchhike back to Spahn Ranch. Now in the car, Charlie has Rosemary's wallet. They pull off of the freeway in Sylmar. In Sylmar, there's a gas station there and a Denny's. And he instructs Linda Kasabian to go hide Mrs. LaBianca's wallet in the bathroom. And she does so. As a matter of fact, she hides it in the toilet tank, hides it so well that it isn't found till 4 months later. In the meantime, Charles goes over to Denny's and grabs milkshakes for everyone in the car. So here we are at the gas station and Denny's where Charles Manson went to get those 4 milkshakes for himself, Susan Atkins, Linda Kasabian, and Steve Clem Grogan, and where Linda Kasabian went to the restroom there at the gas station and hid Rosemary LaBianca's wallet. And then they take off to Venice Beach, and they are looking for an actor named Saladin Nader, who the girls have frequented before, and Charles wanted the girls to kill Saladin right there in his apartment. But Linda Kasabian didn't want to do that. You know, she didn't want anyone else dying, so on purpose, she knocked on the wrong door, and someone else answered and said, "No, there's no Saladin here." And after that, they head back to Spahn Ranch. Now, here is Spahn Ranch today, present time, of course. An aerial shot here I wanted to see up and over it because it's so overgrown to walk in there, which I've got footage of that, which I'll put in. But anyways, the main marker that I went off of was this rock formation here on the left. That would be kind of your landmark to know exactly where it was. It was pretty much across the street from there, and you can see that in these other pictures here dating back to when it was operational. And shout out to Jose Gomez and Rafa Palomo. They went out and got this footage for me, these aerial shots here, and it really gives you a better perspective of the area looking down on it, because like I said, the brush and everything there is kind of tough
to make your way around in there to really see what was going on from the ground level. So thanks to those guys. And here is, on the ground, walking through the brush and stuff. The address then was 12000 Santa Susana Pass. Spahn Ranch was, during this time, headquarters for Charles Manson and his followers. This is where they all stayed, where they all rendezvoused. And these two particular nights that these murders happened, Spahn Ranch was where the orders were handed out to carry out these heinous crimes. This is where the followers left from to go commit them and return to. Second night, left from Spahn Ranch and returned to. It was a 55-acre movie ranch that the followers were living at. That's where they were just hanging out and living for free, and they were almost hiding in plain sight. So it's a very important player in this whole broad scope of things. It is the headquarters of it all. Of course, now it's abandoned and it receives a lot of visitors, but this is where it all derived. Between that and Barker Ranch. Barker Ranch was another ranch where Charles Manson was arrested at for a stolen car ring. And when the officers arrived there to arrest him, he was thinking they were there because of the murders. And it was actually because of stolen cars. So we fast forward to September 1, 1969, about 21 days, roughly 3 weeks after the Cielo Drive murders. And Stephen Weiss, who's a 10-year-old kid, was in his backyard, and that runs adjacent to Beverly Glen Boulevard. Stephen was up on the slope in his backyard near a sprinkler where he came across the gun. So Stephen lived at 3627 Longview Valley Road. Here we are in front of Stephen's house, and right when we pulled up, a truck pulled up in front of there so we couldn't get a great shot of the house. But behind his house is Beverly Glen Boulevard. That's the street that runs parallel. And we were going to stop if we could safely. It's just too busy of a street to do so. But here I'll point it out on Google Earth. You can see where his backyard lines up with Beverly Glen. This is where Tex threw the weapon over the car while in motion, and it landed in Stephen's backyard. So now we move on to the El Coyote restaurant, which is on Beverly Boulevard. And between 9:45 and 10 p.m., manager John Delgadillo had Jay Sebring on the waiting list, a party of four together. Now, this particular manager didn't see the party of four. A woman by the name of Kathy Palmer did. And she stated that the group of four hung out in the bar for about 15 to 20 minutes before they were seated. Now, presumably, this would be Sharon Tate, Wojtek Frykowski, Abigail Folger, and Jay Sebring. Now, when presented with photographs, Ms. Palmer wasn't able to, 100% confirm it was the party of four, but we can presume it was the party of four. Now, in order for that to be the party of four, Abigail Folger would have to have left before 10 because her and her mother spoke on the telephone at the Cielo Drive address, talking about a flight the next day, and it was around that same time before 10. Okay, so here we are at El Coyote, and it is at 7312 Beverly Boulevard in L.A. This is the best Mexican restaurant I've been to. It's been around some 90 years plus, and of course this is the restaurant that Sharon Tate, Jay Sebring, Abigail Folger, and Wojtek Frykowski last dined at. So going through the grounds of Cielo Drive, remember Winifred Chapman picked out the black Porsche belonging to Jay Sebring that was parked there. And inside of that, they found a gram of coke, 6.3 grams of marijuana, and a 2-inch roach. Inside of a plastic bag in a cabinet inside the residence, there was 6.9 grams of marijuana. And in Frykowski and Folger's room, there's 30 grams of hashish, plus 10 capsules that were found to be a new drug at that time, MDA. In Sharon Tate's room, there was marijuana residue in an ashtray, as well as there was a marijuana cigarette on the desk near the front door.
Now, looking at this gruesome scene, the police came up with about five different theories. And the first one was a drug party that was in progress and one of the partygoers went berserk, maybe from drugs or a bad trip, and just murked everybody in there. That was theory one. Theory two, a drug burn. And what that consists of is the killer arrives, or the drug dealer arrives with drugs, and an argument ensues over bad money, bad drugs, whatever the case may be. Now, scenario three is a variety of the second one, where the drug dealer, the killer, whoever, decides he wants to keep the money and the drugs. Scenario four was a residential burglary. And the fifth one was murder for hire. The most likely one would be scenario two, where the killer comes and decides, you know, I'm going to take this money, you know, because of an argument or whatever the reason was. He gets heated, takes the money, takes the drugs, and he's out after he kills everyone there. So about 11 p.m., we know that Stephen Parent stopped at Dale's Market in El Monte, and he had a friend there named John. Stephen Parent was dating John's sister at the time, but he asked John, hey, you want to take a ride with me tonight? And John said no, and probably the best decision of his life, considering what happened. What we do know as well is that approximately 11:45 is when Stephen Parent arrived at the Cielo Drive residence, pulled in, hung out in the guest house, and we know he left at about 12:15 a.m., according to Gerritsen. Now, I don't know if I'd call this a coincidence, but where Stephen Parent lives is 11214 Bryant Avenue, 3.5 blocks away, 0.3 miles away, on the corner of Maple and Bryant, lived one Gene Elroy and James Elroy, who I coincidentally did my first true crime podcast on, the unsolved murder of Gene Elroy. And James Elroy, of course, the famed crime author. Well, that's where they lived. And the tie-in there is that Gene Elroy, her body was found June 22nd, 1958, on the grounds of Arroyo High School. Arroyo High School is where Stephen Parent went to high school. And it's just, it's kind of bizarre to think that within 3.5 blocks are two heavy, infamous crimes that happened. One of them unsolved, and the other one extremely more popular in this day and age. But look that one up. James Elroy, famous crime author, wrote Black Dahlia, L.A. Confidential. Again, his mother Jean Elroy was murdered and her body dumped at Arroyo High School. And to this day, it remains unsolved. Wilfred and Juanita Parent, the mother and father of Stephen, were extremely worried because their son did not come home the night before. And they were just frantic all day. He didn't leave a note, he didn't call, he had never done this type of thing before. So at one point during the evening, Wilfred decided to take the family out to go eat, and they thought maybe when they get back from eating, Stephen will be there. During this time, a reporter that was on scene at Cielo was able to get the license plate off of the Rambler and track it back to the owners of the car, which would be Wilfred and Juanita Parent. When he got there, nobody was home, so he was able to talk to some neighbors. The neighbors told him that, yes, there was a teenage boy that did live at that house. The neighbors got the reporter in touch with Father Byrne, who was the parents' family pastor, and they took a ride down to the corner. All within the same time, Wilfred and Juanita and the family arrived back home from dinner, and when they got there, an LAPD officer pulled up, knocked on the door, handed Mr. Parent a card, and said, call this number. And didn't say much else. Just call this number and left. Mr. Parent called. Turned out to be the county coroner's office. The call was transferred to a deputy coroner. The two spoke briefly, and Mr. Parent told him the situation, what led him to call. And the county coroner on the other end said, your son has apparently been involved in a shooting. Mr. Parent asked, is he dead? And the man on the other end said, we have a body down here and we believe it's your son. Physical characterizations matched. And meanwhile, Father Byrne was down there and he ID'd the body as Stephen Parent. Obviously, the Parent family was frantic, distraught. They crawled in bed, all five of them, mother, father, and the three other children, and finally went to sleep at 5 a.m., just cuddled together, crying until they could fall asleep. Very tragic, very sad, considering Stephen Parent didn't know anybody on the premises, you know, outside of William Gerritsen. I mean, he was there amongst the stars, but didn't even know it. And this is what happened. So Stephen Parent's prom date was interviewed by Movie Geeks United, and she went by the name of Tina for the sake of the podcast. Anyway, she gave an entirely different take on that story in regards to the reporter coming to the house. According to Tina, yes, the parents and the family went out to dinner that Saturday, hoping that Stephen would be home by the time they returned. And according to Tina, they went to Knights of Columbus. Stephen's sister, Janet, who Tina said was around the age of 15, stayed home. And according to Tina, this reporter came knocking on the door, and Janet let the reporter in because the reporter said that the Rambler had been stolen, so this is what this is all about. So he comes in and sneaks that picture, that famous prom picture of Stephen and Tina that was inside of the house. And Stephen's sister at this point thought something was awry, so she made the phone call to where they were having dinner, which was the Knights of Columbus restaurant, according to Tina. And she got a hold of her father there and said, hey, you need to come home because something's going on over here. So I don't know why the story differs in Helter Skelter. I'm going to tend to believe Tina's story on that. Now, another thing that I've seen and read reports on and information on were the vehicle that Wojciech Frykowski was driving. I've read that he had borrowed Sharon's yellow Camaro to drive around town as well. I don't know if that's true or false, but that's just what I've heard. So if anyone has any input on that, please leave a comment down below. Again, this was one of those cases that is extremely vast in information. There's so much going on about in and around this case. So I chose to focus on those two nights. Do more research on this. You'll find out a lot more. It's a very interesting case, as sad and traumatic as it was, but it is definitely one that remains in infamy. So thank you for joining me on this. Please leave any comments, anything I may have gotten wrong, anything that you want to add to it. I would appreciate the input, and thank you for tuning in. Thank you.
later.